Welcome to Nutrition Assessment. In this episode, we have the audio part of class from today, Wednesday, October 20th, 2021. And in this episode, we talk about assessment in older adults. So the key takeaways here are, while there are some physiological changes that we expect with aging, we really need to take an individualized approach with each person that we work with. And with all older adults, and for that matter, all adults, we need to honor their autonomy and their ability and right to make decisions for themselves. And another mention of thank you to Nathan Pyle for creating the Strange Planet webcomic, which in more cases than one, condenses my entire point of this lecture down to one webcomic. So if you haven't seen Strange Planet, you should check that out. Nathan Pyle. Announcements. Most of you have had lab already, but lab is back in Atwell Hall today. We're going to be hanging out in the computer lab just getting stuff done. I think that worked pretty well yesterday for folks. So we'll do it again today for Wednesday, folks. I don't think I have any other announcements. Did you know, today's Did You Know, that the university has a wellness assessment? And so this is actually run by Student Life. I've never done it, so I would love for somebody to try it and just tell me what it's like. But it goes over what they call the nine dimensions of wellness. So it's things like social, environmental, emotional, financial, intellectual. There's a whole bunch of components to overall wellness. If I were way more organized, maybe we should have done this as an assignment for the class, but I'm not that organized, so I'm just letting you know. And what's nice about it is when you complete it, it like gives you the results right away and then can like direct you towards resources that the university has. Also, I'll just throw out there, the university does look at this data. They compile it in aggregate, anonymize it and compile it in aggregate, and make decisions about like what else the university needs to be doing for students. So if you feel like there's something the university should be doing, you could sort of give them an indication of that by filling out this survey. So just making you aware of that. It's a little chilly now, but yoga on the oval looks like fun. Exit ticket from Monday that I wanted to address. This is a really good one that came in. How do you calculate ideal body weight for infants and or children? It is not the Hamwee equation. So I have a quote here straight from the evidence analysis library where I found this. To calculate percent ideal body weight for an infant or child, plot the length or height on a growth chart to identify the length or height for age percentile, right? So find they're at the 60th percentile for height, for example. And then locate the ideal body weight as the weight at the same percentile as that height for the same age and sex, and divide actual body weight by ideal body weight, multiply by 100 to get percent ideal body weight. So I said with your kids, or with my kids or any kids, the height percentile and the weight percentile don't have to match, and that remains true. My daughter is tall and skinny. God love her, she got my husband's genes, not mine. So that's fine. But if you're concerned with a child's weight or growth for age, you can look at what would the weight be at X percentile for this height, and then use that as an example of an ideal body weight. Does that make sense? Okay, we'll practice that in lab in a month. There's also an article I found, evaluation of different methods used to calculate ideal body weight in the pediatric population. That is a more recent article. So I did pull this from the evidence analysis library, but this article is from 2019. So it'd be interesting to compare those two and see what they have to say about ideal body weight in kids. And then today we're gonna shift gears. We're looking a little bit at sort of this lifespan of nutrition and look at older adults. So as we talk about older adults, let's start with the concept of chronological age versus functional age. Right, so chronological age is how many years old you are, right? The thing you've been telling people since you could hold up a hand and say, I'm this many, right? How many years old are you? Whereas functional age is really more a matter of what are you able to do? Can you do all of your activities of daily living independently? Do you need assistance? And that can vary, right? You could be 40 years old and need a lot of assistance, right? And you could be 95 years old and living independently. So it's two different concepts, basically, is how many years old are you And then what is your functional age? We also need to define how old is old, right? So if we say older adults, at what point do you become an older adult? Per the Older Americans Act, which was written in 1965, older adulthood begins at age 60. Okay? Now, this picture is now 7 years old. Christie Brinkley is now 67. But, okay, might it be time to update our definition of old? So when Social Security was first created in 1935, right? In 1935, we said that you would get these benefits starting at age 60 or 65, I forget which exactly. Life expectancy at that point was 62, right? So you weren't expected to live much longer. You weren't expected to need much assistance because life expectancy was not much longer than that age itself. But life expectancy has increased, although it decreased in 2020. So life expectancy has increased. The way we live our lives, we're living longer and healthier. Christie Brinkley is an aberration from the norm. I can call her that because she's a supermodel, right? There are a lot of factors at play here. Genetics, lifestyle, possibly Photoshop, right? But like, here's Christie Brinkley at 60 looking better than I ever have or will. So let's think about, like, is 60 old? If you were walk up to them who's 60 and tell them they're old, how do you think they'd take that? Maybe not so great. So life expectancy now, if you make it to the age of 65 in the year 2021, then life expectancy for men is 83 and for women is 85. We live a lot longer than we did when this definition of old was first created. Christie Brinkley was born in 1954, so she is now 67. We can actually divide old into young old and old old, right? So young old is age 65 to 74. Actually, Christie Brinkley and Oprah Winfrey both born in 1954, so they're both 67 years old, right? So they would fall into that young old category. These pictures are from last year, so they were 66 at the time I found these. But I don't think either of them would take too kindly to being told that they're old, right? Maybe. Maybe not. I don't know them personally, obviously. And then old old is age 75 and above. And here I'm picking on Queen Elizabeth because she is one of the most photographed people in the world. She is 95 years old. So she is greater than 75. She falls in that old old category. Now, as someone who unabashedly loves following all things the royal family, it's been written many times that she, up until the pandemic, maintained a calendar that some of her assistants had trouble keeping up with. Like, people who worked for her couldn't keep up with her. So her functional age seems to be pretty darn good, even though she's 95 years old. So it's a big difference between chronological age and functional age. We can't just assume that because someone has a certain number of years or a certain date of birth, that means that they're going to be incapacitated, right? Now, that said, we'll get into this. There are some physiological changes that happen with aging. In fact, Christie Brinkley was actually tweeting, Instagramming, I forget, last year about her hip replacement, right? So, God love her, she looks great, but she had worn out her hip and needed a hip replacement. There are things that do happen despite all of our best efforts with aging. Some decidedly less famous individuals. This is my grandmother on the left here. This was when she was 89 years old at my cousin's wedding, and she's posing with another cousin doing duck face and learning how to take selfies, right? So is she acting her age? I mean, I don't know. What's that even mean? Functionally, though, she does need a lot of assistance. She needs a walker to get around. She has limited mobility. She has some difficulty performing some of her ADLs. Whereas, over here on the right, This is Mr. Clark, who we have adopted as the grandfather of our family. My grandfather passed away like 50 years ago. Never met him, unfortunately. But Mr. Clark has been my grandmother's gentleman friend for like 30 years. So here's Mr. Clark. This is from last year. You can tell because he's wearing his mask. Riding the shopping cart into the parking lot, right? So my aunt lives nearby my grandmother and Mr. Clark, and she was trying to find Mr. Clark one day, and so she was waiting for him in the local grocery store parking lot and managed to snap this picture of him riding the cart into the parking lot coming out of the grocery store. Also, doing all of his own grocery shopping at 95 years old during a global pandemic. The man lives independently in a two-story house and needs no assistance. Like, hashtag goals, right? I would like to age like Mr. Clark. So the Older Americans Act was written in 1965 to support individuals over the age of 60. In 1965, life expectancy was about 70 years, right? So it might be time to update what we think of as old. I assure you, you have faculty, not me this time, but you have faculty who fall into that young old category who would not like to be told that they are elderly, right? Not gonna take that well. On top of which, I have colleagues who could like bench press me who are in that young old category, right? So let's talk about old. What does it actually mean? So if you would like to assess your physical ability, this is, it has since been widely debunked, but this was huge on like the Today Show and everywhere else about 3 years ago. There was a study that showed that the sitting rising test, so it's actually the ability to stand, you notice she's not using her hands, she's not pushing off with her knees, she's just standing straight up from a cross-legged position. It's the ability to sit and to stand without using any assistance. And there was a research study that found that if you're not able to do this, you're at a greater risk of mortality. All right, so, you know, all well and good. This is a fun one you can do at home anytime. I could do it last year. I forgot to try it last night and see if I can still do it. Maybe after class I'll try, see if I can do it. This was widely debunked because in part it was not the best study design. But the point of, you can read all about it here. The point of something like that is if you're not able to sit and stand on your own, you're going to have a harder time going to the bathroom, getting to the grocery store, purchasing food, making food, all those things, well, creating food too. So more formal tests, we talked about these earlier with the functional assessments for strength and flexibility. A sit to stand test is again where you are going from a seated position and without using your arms to push up, how many times can you stand up and sit back down? This is a functional assessment that's used to assess functional decline, and it is predictive of morbidity and mortality. And again, the scoring starts at age 60. The assumption is if you are younger than 60, you can do this, right? So we do have this definition that persists of by the age of 60, the body is getting older, right? No matter how the person acts, how much duck face they do, right? The body is getting older, and there are some physiological changes that go with that. So we went over some of these functional tests. I've got them grayed out here because we talked about them earlier. The functional tests, for the most part, are going to be performed by the occupational therapists and the physical therapists that are a part of your care team, right? But you should have a sense of what those things are and why someone might do them. You, as the dietitian, you are more likely to ask questions, right? You want to ask about their activities of daily living. If you are making a nutritional recommendation that they go to the store and buy fresh foods or particular foods, and you want them to then prepare those things at home, then you need to get a sense of what is their strength, what is their functional capacity. So questions, flour comes in a 5-pound bag typically. Can you lift a 5-pound bag of flour? If you lift that 5-pound bag of flour, which is always on the bottom shelf, by the way, right, the very bottom at the grocery store, if you lift that 5-pound bag of flour and put it in the cart, in the bottom of the cart, can you then get it back out of the cart? So I went grocery shopping with my grandmother years ago, and I realized she was only using the seat where you put a kid, right, to put the groceries in because she couldn't reach the bottom of the cart. She could drop something in there, but she couldn't then get it back out of the bottom of the cart to put it on the conveyor belt. So she was limited in how much food she would buy to what would fit in that top seat part of the grocery cart. Right? So can you reach items in the bottom of the grocery cart? Can you chop produce? I was prepping soup the other day. Raw carrots are hard, y'all. Like, I have a hard time chopping. I know I have special reasons, but like, I had a hard time chopping those carrots. That was hard to do. So can you do something like that? Do you have arthritis? Do you have, you know, other limitations to being able to prep food? Think about, all right, so do you have adequate balance to remove items from the oven, right? For the most part, all the cookware that I use is very lightweight because I'm not the strongest of individuals. But if someone prefers to use like cast iron cookware or like a Dutch oven, Can you lift that thing and get it down into the oven and back out again, right? Those are heavy things to manipulate. So you can ask questions, you know, are they able to do these types of things or do they have the desire to, right? If someone lives alone, eating is a very social thing, and they live alone, do they even have the desire to go to all this effort? Anybody ever eat just a bowl of cereal for dinner because you're tired and it's easy? Yeah, me too, right? So if you don't have the incentive to, I mean, no judgment, right? It's delicious. But if you don't have the incentive to prepare elaborate meals or prepare a varied diet because you live alone, that's a concern. So, older adults. Let's talk about older adults a little bit more. Here's where we get into the slightly less uplifting but very important conversation to have. Everyone who is alive today will die, right? It's not a threat. I'm not saying it's going to happen anytime soon. Heaven help me, I hope it doesn't. But dying is a part of life. And so we need to look at things like causes of death. So I keep mentioning physiological changes as we age. Let's look at top causes of death for adults ages 25 to 44. So this is data from 2019. These are the leading causes of death in 2019. Let's all hold a minute and wait and see what we get for 2020 and 2021. I would expect influenza and pneumonia to shoot up, right, and become a respiratory disease. Is going to shoot up with coronavirus. But this is 2019 data. So this is the before times data. For adults aged 25 to 44, accidents is the number one cause of death. All right, stay away from ladders, kids, right? Just don't go climbing where you shouldn't be climbing. Unintentional injury is the number one cause of death, ages 25 to 44. So it's not a chronic disease in this case, right? Suicide, regrettably, is number two. Did I mention the student wellness assessment and the wellness resources that the campus has? This is a big problem, right? This is a big problem. It is a big problem for students enrolled in college. It is a big problem for all adults. It is an especially big problem ages 25 to 44, right? We need to talk about this more. Cancer comes in as the third leading cause of death, followed by heart disease, homicide, heaven help me. And then we have chronic liver disease and cirrhosis, diabetes, stroke, influenza and pneumonia, and then septicemia. I was excited to see that childbirth has dropped out of the top 10. That was in the top 10 in 2017, right? Right? It's, you wouldn't think so, but it was the 10th leading cause of death in 2017. Childbirth in the 6 weeks after giving birth was still a leading cause of death in 2017, which is that's a whole class in and of itself. So, all right, so 25 to 44. At this point, your body is fairly young in terms of chronological age. As we get older, those categories shift. So for ages 65 and over, I've got this split, 65 and over, so all adults over age 65, and then all adults over age 85, heart disease is the number one cause of death in older adults, followed by cancer, and then we have chronic lower respiratory disease for 65 and over. Chronic lower respiratory disease like COPD. Stroke, Alzheimer's disease makes an appearance. Diabetes, unintentional injuries has gone from the number one cause of death to, let's see, I've got it down here. It's gone down to the seventh leading cause of death. Kidney disease, influenza, pneumonia, and Parkinson's disease. For over the age of 85, heart disease is still number one. Cancer is still number two. Alzheimer's disease pulls into number three. And then we have, again, stroke, that chronic lower respiratory disease, influenza, pneumonia, diabetes, kidney disease, and hypertension. Get your flu shots, all right? We'll throw that out there. But also, look at these types of diseases. Heart disease and cancer have huge components where nutrition can influence the outcome, right? So there's lifestyle factors make a huge difference for both risk of heart disease and risk of cancer. Stroke has a major nutritional component. Alzheimer's disease, I don't think we know yet. We don't know enough yet about Alzheimer's disease, although anything that we do that is a healthier lifestyle is going to reduce the risk of any chronic disease. Diabetes, you guys know this, major nutritional components. Kidney disease, there's a lot we need to look at with nutrition therapy for renal failure. Parkinson's disease. So Parkinson's disease, once you are undergoing treatment for Parkinson's, the number of medications that are prescribed is pretty phenomenal. And those medications very often have drug-nutrient interactions. So what I'm saying is your role for an older adult in terms of nutrition is pretty big, right? There's definitely a huge role for nutrition to play. Also, if you want to age well, you need to start now, right? It's not like you can turn 65 and say, all right, now I'm going to follow a heart-healthy diet. This is really a lifelong thing. You got to start early with those healthy habits, even though when we're younger, that's not typically as much of a threat, so to speak. It's not as immediate of a threat. In addition, with older adults, these are other common conditions. So there are physiological changes that happen to the best of us. The body is aging. So you have age-related macular degeneration, so loss of sight, arthritis, tell me all about it, right? Cataracts, dementia, depression, diabetes, disability, hypertension, incontinence. Somebody emailed me yesterday and asked if I knew where they could order adult diapers. I was like, I love that you think I know the answer to this. I don't know the answer to this. They went specifically to order it through OSU's ordering system, which is weird. But I was like, I don't know. I've never had to do that one before. Obesity, osteoporosis, pressure ulcers, sarcopenia, and unattended weight loss. There are a lot of nutrition components to all of these things, right? So there's a huge role for you to play in terms of health and wellness for older adults. Another thing to keep in mind, older adults are more likely than younger adults to have one or more chronic conditions, right? When you have one or more chronic conditions, you become more medically complex. There are more factors to consider in the management of that condition or conditions. And very often, if you're prescribed more than one medication, you end up with something called polypharmacy, where you have lots of medications. So an example of this, when my dad was being treated for leukemia and they sent us home from the hospital, I think he was on 20 different meds, right? That's a lot. That's a lot to manage. Parkinson's disease. I had an uncle who had Parkinson's disease. I don't even know how many meds he was on. It was a lot of medications. But when you have that many medications, you have to be very aware of drug-nutrient interactions, if they are there, and often they are, and then any impact that those drugs may have on absorption. There are also physical changes to aging. So energy needs decrease as we age. We lose lean body mass at a rate of about 2 to 5% per decade. And I think this starts in your 30s. Means I got to get on it. So diminished lean body mass, that's that sarcopenia, that loss of lean body mass. We can attenuate that somewhat, but we need to make sure you have adequate protein intake, which is your job, and that you're doing resistance exercise, lifting weights, right? Getting out and walking is great, but it's not going to help preserve lean body mass like resistance exercise is going to do. There is a decrease in immune function. My parents are both over the age of 65. They got their flu shots, but they got a stronger dose flu shot than I did because they have decreased immune function. In order to get their immune system to respond as strongly, they needed a stronger dose of the flu shot. Hearing loss is very common in older adults, has major implications in terms of how well people are able to participate in their social lives. If you can't hear the person across the room, you're not going to engage in that conversation. How much people want to get out and about and engage with other people has impacts on nutrition and exercise and physical activity. Loss of taste and smell. So as you have an increase in the threshold for taste, like you're going to need more salt to be able to taste something, right? Which is not necessarily something we want if you have hypertension, but that's loss of taste and smell happens with age. There's also a reduced number of ACNR cells of the salivary glands, so you have dry mouth. You have less spit going around, so you might drink more, and if it's not water, but something caloric, that can make a difference. Delayed gastric emptying is possible, so you could have early satiety, someone who feels full before they've had much to eat, which means they're not eating very much, which means they may not get a varied diet or enough nutrition. And you can have reduced gastric acid secretion, or achloridia. And so why does that matter? Well, the first step of digestion is chewing the food, right? That's number one. But that's immediately followed by breaking down the food with that stomach acid. And also think back to intrinsic factor and B12, right? So if you're going to be able to absorb B12, you have to have adequate stomach acid. And if that's missing, you're not going to absorb B12. There is also something that is very common in older adults called atrophic gastritis. So basically atrophy of the stomach, of the cells, of the stomach lining. And with that, you'll have reduced secretion of gastric acid, right? So you'll have a higher pH, a less acidic pH, and decreased secretion of intrinsic factor, which has got to bind to that B12 in order for us to be able to absorb it. So B12 deficiency is very common in older adults. And because it's caused by a lack of acid and a lack of intrinsic factor, giving someone oral B12 may have no effect, right? If you're not able to absorb it through an oral route, supplementing with more B12 through the mouth is not going to make any difference, right? So B12 is like my favorite B vitamin. We'll talk about this when we get to lab tests. But it's important with B12 to figure out, is it a deficiency in the diet? Is it a deficiency in the absorption? Because you are what you absorb far more than you are what you eat, right? It matters far more what you're able to absorb. Other changes, there are changes to the accessory organs. So pancreatic enzyme secretion may diminish, so you have a more difficult time digesting foods. Gallstone prevalence increases. So that can cause a lot of pain, particularly with any high-fat foods. There are liver function changes with age. So hepatic clearance of drugs decreases, liver size decreases, and the portal blood flow decreases. So you can have a change in how you metabolize medication as you age. Something you've taken for many years may no longer work or may be more effective, depending on how the liver processes it. So all of these changes in digestion, absorption, and metabolism influence the nutrient availability in the older adult. So even if the person is eating a picture-perfect diet, I say that with quotes, picture-perfect diet, whatever that may be, if the body is not able to absorb it, you can still be at risk for deficiencies. There are also changes that can happen in the small intestine. So the mucosal surface area, so think back to the villi and the microvilli and the like outstandingly huge surface area that we have for absorption inside the small intestine, that can actually decrease a bit with age. Some of those brush border enzymes may have decreased activity. So in many older adults, they have tolerated lactose all their life and now they become lactose intolerant. That can happen. Zinc absorption decreases with age. That has a huge role in immunity as well. And calcium absorption decreases with age. So talking about osteoporosis and risk for fracture, if you're not able to absorb calcium, that is a problem as well. So there's a position paper from the Academy that says food and nutrition for older adults promoting health and wellness. These are all the things you need to take into account. So there are some things that we cannot change, right? So genetics, age, gender, or more appropriately, sex. Those are factors that we cannot change, but they have an influence. Women tend to outlive men. Again, not a threat. It's just sort of how it works out. But in addition to that, we need to look at all of these things. So medical or health status. Do they have multiple conditions that they're managing? Do they have multiple medications that they're taking? Are there any changes in taste, smell, appearance, texture? Oral health. If someone is missing teeth or has dentures, that makes a big difference in what you're able to chew and what you might want to eat. Physical and functional status. So any physical limitations, any issues with balance, strength and endurance and physical activity have big implications for how well you're able to care for yourself. Cognition, change in mental status. So change in mental status is not a given, right? Just because someone is older does not mean we should say, oh, they're forgetful because they're old, or, oh, they're saying strange things because they're old, right? Many micronutrient deficiencies can actually cause an altered mental state. We haven't gotten here yet, but we will. So I just said many older adults have difficulty absorbing B12. A B12 deficiency can lead to an altered cognitive state. So just because someone is old doesn't mean that that alone explains why they have a change in cognition. You need to look further and see, is there a reason that this person is asking really strange questions or that they're not remembering really simple things? We also need to look at depression and emotional needs. Food is so much more than just calories, right? Food is absolutely a social and cultural thing. Typical intake, their beliefs and behaviors, and then advertising, and then environmental. So I mentioned the student wellness assessment has as a component of environmental health. This is still a component for older adults as well. Living situation and economics, that's kind of a big deal, right? So Social Security, which I have no expectation of drawing from when I'm an older adult, not only because I don't think it'll be there, but also because I don't pay into it. I'm an employee of the state. Social Security said, we'll help you with some costs starting at age 65, but also we don't expect you to live much past 62, right? That was when that was established in 1935. People live a lot longer now, and it's very common for older adults to outlive their savings, right? So if you ever heard the term, I'm living on a fixed income, first of all, who isn't, right? Who does not have a fixed income? But the idea there is that you have a limited income and you're concerned about how much money you have left for however many years you have left. And so when you look at your food and nutrition recommendations for older adults, something like, can they afford the foods that you're recommending? Or can they afford the medication and the food that you want them to eat? Those are things we need to take into account. Also, speaking of aging well, if you would like to age well, you need to start now with healthy habits. And if you would like to have money as an older adult, you should probably start saving now as well. That's kind of hard to grasp, I know, but the two are connected, I promise. But our current social systems for supporting older adults are pretty much inadequate because they were designed, gosh, 1935. We're getting on 90 years ago that was set up. So the Older Americans Act was established in 1965. It was most recently updated in 2020. But there's a lot that we need to think about in terms of the environment around older adults to see if we're really able to support healthy living in that population. So priorities for older adult nutrition. Adequate fluid, protein, and energy are, of course, our priorities at any age. But with older adults, you can have a diminished sense of thirst. So you have more concern about getting that adequate hydration. You also have that sarcopenia and that loss of lean body mass. So you're paying particular attention to that protein intake. And if an older adult has just lost the desire to eat, right, then you're really concerned with the energy intake as well. We talked about environmental factors. Affordability of foods and ease of access are both concerns. And palatability. If someone has recommended a sodium-restricted, low-fat diet and it eliminates many of that person's favorite foods that they like to eat, then they may choose to just stop eating, right? So we'll talk about that in a second. Like, is that really our goal here? Because our priority here is to preserve lean body mass. For an older adult, we want to preserve lean body mass even if that person is overweight or obese. So we're not looking for rapid weight loss. We want to preserve that lean mass because it is going to improve quality of life and quantity of life. So I split this in multiple videos last year, which is why there's so many header slides, but assessment. One of the things that's a little bit different for an older adult than for a younger adult, when you're assessing weight in an older adult, you might want to look at usual body weight instead of an ideal body weight, right? So my grandmother is 93 years old. She's nowhere near her ideal body weight for height, and that's fine. But if she were to deviate drastically from her usual body weight, we would be concerned, right? If she were to lose a lot of weight compared to her usual body weight, or if she were to gain a lot of weight compared to her usual body weight, it could be a fluid overload, right? So what does this person typically weigh? What does normal, quote unquote, normal look like for this person, right? Again, we want to preserve lean body mass. So losing a lot of weight is not necessarily a good thing. When my dad was undergoing his cancer treatment, he had zero appetite, didn't want to eat at all. And he was like, well, I'm a little overweight. This is a great time for me to lose weight. And I was like, no, Dad, no, it's not, right? No, it is not. We don't want you losing lean body mass. And the thing that finally worked for him was, Dad, I need you to eat so you can pick up your grandkids still when this is all said and done, right? That's why I want you to eat. Because somehow, as he's undergoing treatment, going into the interconversion of metabolic substrates and the preservation of lean body mass versus starvation state going through protein stores wasn't going to cut it for him, right? But I want you to be able to pick up your grandkids. That worked. That worked for my dad. So usual body weight is something we want to look at more so than ideal body weight. Plus, for someone who's 93 years old, who cares what the ideal body weight is, right? You're 93. That's pretty good. So when we are assessing older adults, there are a variety of screening tools that can be used in addition to something called the nutrition-focused physical exam, which we will be spending 2 weeks on in November. So we will go over NFPE in great detail very soon here, but just put a pin in that thought for now, that NFPE is really the way that we want to assess risk for malnutrition. However, even though that's the way we want to assess, sometimes you just don't have that much time. NFPE does take time to complete. So these are some listed screening tools for older adults. These screening tools could be built into an electronic health record and administered by anyone on the care team. So the nurse who's checking a patient in, for example, could run through these questions and screen for malnutrition risk. Most of these tools are valid, well, they're all validated. But most of these tools, the best way to use them is to say, hey, there's something going on here. I need to go look and see more to the story for this patient, right? So it may be that their BMI is normal. They haven't expressed any concerns. But after asking about questions about appetite or desire to eat or recent weight changes, one of these screening tools could flag the patient as, hey, someone should follow up, right? So there is a place for these tools. Subjective global assessment is a little bit more involved than just asking a few questions. I think of subjective global assessment as the precursor to NFPE. SGA is what we learned when I was a student. It's actually looking at the medical record and looking at the patient. It's a little more involved. There are other tools that come out of Australia. There's a tool that looks specifically at community nutrition, so evaluating risk in community-dwelling adults. There's tools specifically for long-term care settings. So people living in a long-term care facility, making sure that they have adequate nutrition as well. Notice this one looks at both biochemical markers, cholesterol and albumin, which we'll talk about albumin, as well as emotional factors, right? Sadness, loss of weight, and eating problems. There's a geriatric nutritional risk index, again, looking at albumin. We'll talk about albumin. And then this one is probably, I think, the most helpful, this mnemonic device determine checklist. So this sort of encapsulates everything that we just said we want to think about for an older adult. Is their disease present? Are they eating poorly? Do they have tooth loss or mouth pain? Is there economic hardship? Are they not able to afford the foods that we want them to eat? Reduced social contact, right? Food is a social thing. We got Halloween, Thanksgiving, Christmas coming up. It's a very social thing. Multiple medicines, that's the idea of polypharmacy, having many medications that someone is managing. Involuntary weight loss or involuntary weight gain, right? It could be that someone is consuming too many calories, or it could be that they're retaining fluid and they have edema. Either way, we want to get more to that story. Need for assistance with self-care. If you're not able to take care of yourself, right? If you're not able to take a shower or able to dress yourself, you're probably also not chopping up raw fruits and vegetables to eat, especially if you have tooth pain or mouth pain. And then there's that elder word. People may not like to be called elderly. We'll just throw that out there. The preferred term is older adult, although for this mnemonic device, elder years does fit. We need an E at the end. / if I make it past 80, yeah, you can call me old. That's cool, right? I don't think I'm going to be old until I'm 80. Don't call me old until then. But if I make it to 80, yeah, you can call me old. That's fine. All right. One more big concept I want to get at for today is this idea of winning the battle but losing the war, which is a saying that gets at the idea of, okay, if you pick a fight on this one thing, this smaller thing, and you win that fight, but you lose the ultimate goal of what you were trying to work towards, right? Then that wasn't actually successful, right? So win the battle but lose the war, not the goal, right? The bigger goal is making sure that the person, well, let's think about this. What is the biggest goal for you as you become an older adult? Do you want quantity of years or quality of years? I mean, both, right? But if you had to pick one or the other, probably quality, right? So when we look at how we had traditionally done, like 10 or more years ago, traditionally done meal service in a long-term care setting, it was a lot of winning the battle but losing the war. So let me explain. They're called the new dining practice standards, but they were released in 2013, so we should talk about the new name for the new dining practice standards. These were nationally agreed upon food and dining standards for long-term care settings that actually shifted from, instead of providing, this is the diet that you get, this is the sodium-restricted, low-fat, carbohydrate-controlled diet that you get, right? And you can eat it or not, right? We will provide you exactly what we think you should have, and your choices are to eat it or not. That was the old way of doing it. The new way of doing it is saying, you know what? Older adults have autonomy. They have the ability to decide for themselves. Let them choose what they want to eat. So instead of this traditional focus on your diagnosis, we will treat you with food and we will give you food that you don't want to eat, and then you don't eat it, and then you become malnourished, and now we've lost the war because we picked the wrong battle, right? We have data to back this up, right? So restricting older adults to what we know is best, right? I put that in air quotes because it's very paternalistic to say to someone who's an adult and say, well, we know what's best for you, so we're going to restrict you to these things, actually led to poorer health outcomes than allowing people to have some autonomy and choose what they wanted. Doesn't mean it has to be a free-for-all, right? But like you would any other adult, you present the options and you let them choose. Because when people are able to choose, they choose a more varied diet and they consume more calories and more protein, which is going to lead to better health outcomes. So you can read these dining practice standards. But basically, yeah, you could have a diabetic diet or a calorie-controlled diet, but allow the person to make some changes. Same idea for low sodium, cardiac, altered consistency. So we'll talk about swallowing difficulties next week in lab. So an altered consistency diet. Has anyone ever had a thickened beverage? Use thicket in your coffee, for example. How much coffee are you going to drink if it's sludge? It's gross, right? Older adults have the ability to decide, I know I'm a swallowing risk. I know I'm a risk for aspiration. I don't care. Give me my coffee without being thickened, right? They can make that decision. So older adults who consume a more varied diet have better outcomes. So allowing people to choose what they want is going to actually have a better impact. So there's a chance by the time you're done with all of our courses here that you'll leave thinking, oh, well, when I encounter this type of patient, I will recommend this kind of diet and that will help them and they will want to do it unquestioningly, right? I mean, no, because you're already seeing standardized patients who don't do this. But people are human. They can just reject everything you recommend for them. And that's an option. They can do that. So it's shifting to this individualized support instead of a diagnosis-focused approach to saying we're gonna support the individual and let them choose what they want. So this is part of the position statement from the Academy. This is from 2018. You can read, but some major points to look at here. It's called Individualized Nutrition Approaches for Older Adults. So the recommendation is that the registered dietitian nutritionist assess, evaluate, and recommend appropriate nutrition interventions according to each individual's medical condition, desires, and rights to make healthcare choices, right? You can recommend whatever you think is best, and the patient can follow all of it, some of it, or none of it. They can do that. When you're looking at this, you need to assess risk versus benefits of therapeutic diets, especially for frail older adults. So, Jill, I'm going to pick on you. You said your 12-year-old dog was dying of cancer. What did you let the dog eat? Bologna and hot dogs. Bologna and hot dogs, okay? And you went back to the vet, and the vet said, it's too high fat, that's really bad for him. And you said, what? He's dying of cancer. Let him eat the bologna and hot dogs, this poor dog, right? And you did. So for a nutritionally, for a frail older adult, are you winning the battle or are you winning the war, right? Are you helping them have good quality of life? Are you helping them maintain some lean body mass? Are you helping them enjoy their fine? Like, we're all going to die. That is part of the process. But we in Western medicine tend towards, I'm going to fight it. We're going to fight it. We're going to fight it. We're going to live as long as possible. Down to the last second, we're going to fight off death. It happens. It's never going to not happen. I mean, not in my lifetime. It's not going to not happen. So including older individuals in decisions about food can increase their desire to eat, which improves quality of life. And if you've improved their desire to eat, you've probably also improved their quantity of life. So it does matter that you let people have some autonomy. And after saying all of that, you could also just look at one single webcomic, which explains it all. So this is a strange planet, what I know, right? See? But it's so perfect. Why sprinkle minerals before ingesting? I know I enjoy sprinkled minerals, but this could decrease your final revolution count. Perhaps I prefer fewer revolutions and more minerals. Maybe I like salt. Maybe I would rather eat more salt, even if I live fewer hours, days, or months. You can do that, right? Thank you, Nathan Pyle, for summarizing my entire lecture in four panels, right? So with that little bit of humor, end-of-life nutrition care. This is another topic that we just don't talk about enough, and I'm not going to talk about it enough either because I have 5 minutes left in class, and now I'm starting this topic. But end-of-life nutrition care is something that we do need to talk about. We need to talk about it more, and we need to talk about it with our families and friends, because when we get to end of life, it may be, so the dog, I'm going to pick on your dog, because that's less, oh, Shelby, bless. That's a very sad example, but it's slightly less sad than me pulling in a family member, which I could do. So palliative care. Palliative care means we acknowledge that this person has a terminal illness. Right? We acknowledge that this person is going to die in the next months or years, right? And we've decided not to aggressively pursue a treatment that is intended to cure this, right? We acknowledge there is no cure for this. That doesn't mean that you withhold care, right? Palliative care can include quality of life, it can include pain management, it can include nutrition and hydration. Right? It can include providing people with what they want to eat, right? Not necessarily a restricted diet at that point. You can have what you want to eat and hydration. At the same time, the patient has the right to refuse nutrition and or hydration, right? So why would someone do that? Why would someone refuse nutrition or hydration? Well, I mentioned I had an uncle who had Parkinson's disease. He had an advanced directive. He had decided earlier on in his, I mean, he had decades of Parkinson's disease, and he had decided earlier on in the disease progression, when he reached a point, which he knew would come with Parkinson's, when he reached a point where he could no longer feed himself, he did not want a tube feed. He did not want to be kept alive through a tube feed. He could have been, right? We could have provided adequate nutrition and hydration through a tube feed, but that's not how he wanted to live. He did not want to live confined to bed, kept alive with a tube feed and hydration. That was his choice. And we as his family honored that choice. So this is where it becomes really important to have something called an advanced directive or a healthcare proxy who knows what you want in the case of a persistent vegetative state. If I'm hit by a University Village bus, which is my go-to example, and I am in a persistent vegetative state, pull the plug. If I'm not coming back, I do not want to be kept alive with a tube feed and hydration if I'm not really going to come back to being me, right? That's my choice. This is something that we in the United States do not do enough across any socioeconomic group, any age, any demographic. And I mention that because as the dietitian, you could be pulled into consult and say, If we give mom a tube feed and an IV, will she stay alive? And you may have to say, well, yes, but do you know what she wanted? Right? Was there an advance directive? Is there a healthcare proxy? If that type of thing isn't determined ahead of time, and there are multiple family members with varying opinions about what should happen next, you can imagine the minefield that that becomes. So there are major ethical and legal issues that we need to be aware of in feeding and hydration when we're looking at end-of-life care. Because yes, and there have been some very famous cases, you can keep someone alive for years who's in a coma if you provide them with tube feed and hydration. But is that the best outcome, right? So we need to look at cultural norms regarding death as well. The prevailing cultural norm in the United States is we are going to fight death, right? As if it's something we could completely defeat. We can't, right? But that's how we approach it in Western medicine. Other cultures may have a different approach. They may see death as this is part of the process. And so they may not want additional measures, or some would refer to it as artificial nutrition, right? They may not want that. And it's your job as a dietitian to respect that, right? So that's my super uplifting topic to end us for today. So of course, let me bring in one more Strange Planet comic. I love this one. Survive, chuckle, and show affection. Life is in fact short, but there's a lot of ways we can improve that quality of life through nutrition and physical activity. And again, start early, start now, if you want to have a healthy older adult years.